You know, and obviously the first thing that comes to your mind is the battle that has been raging for 50 years or more between pro-choice believers of abortion and those pro-life believers who believe in the preservation of life, especially for the innocent unborn babies. And it is true that this is a big part of what the lesson is going to be upon, but it goes even beyond that, and that is really the purpose. The sanctity of human life is for the purpose of the life. We were created for him and by him and for his purpose, and therefore it is to be revered and reverenced. Our bodies and who we are, our creation, is not to be taken lightly. For there are some things that he created in us that he did not create anywhere else in any other being that walks upon the face of the earth. He made us for a particular purpose, and in this day of protesting and death that is rampant, we can't even turn the news on anymore without the lead stories being all about death. It almost gets to be numb to us that death is just a part of everyday life that we read, and we almost forget about the sanctity of life and the tragedy of premature death because of all that we see around us. But we want to be reminded this morning of who we are in God and the sanctity of that. And I wanted to start with Genesis, the first chapter of Genesis, and to remind us once again of God's perfect creation and perfect purpose for us. It says, "And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them," man, "have dominion," that's authority, that's very important. "Let this created being," we've created everything else. This is the last thing we're going to create. All the fish in the sea, all the fowl in the air, all the animals that have walked on, are walking on the earth. Let's make man and give them authority, give them dominion over everything that is walking on the earth, that is in the sea and over the air. There's nothing greater that we have created than what we're about to create. That's something that we've got to remind ourselves. "Over all the fowl of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. And I want to stop there. The image of God, we know from Scripture that God doesn't have a human body, a human form. The Scriptures tell us that God is a spirit. And we must worship him in spirit because he doesn't have a human form, even though there are times when you hear the statements in the Bible about the finger of God, the arm of God, or, you know, the eyes of the Lord are upon us, and things like this, what gives body parts. But we're told that he's not a physical being that walks around. He can take, of course, the form of anything that he chooses, but he is a spirit. So what is this image that we're being made into? Because obviously when God created man, he created him with body parts, with functions internally, with the ability to function the way he was supposed to, with a body, arms and legs and things of this nature. What is the likeness? This is the difference between what God made in man and made in the human, in the animal world. Because in God's likeness, God is a spirit, therefore he put in human beings a spirit. That spirit created a soul, and that soul is made up of your individual personality, your purpose, your will, your emotions, how you react. You are an individual soul, your personality itself. That soul has a body that functions on a daily basis that we are to take care of. But inside of our heart, the heartbeat of our bodies, lives a spirit that the Lord has put in us from day one when he created man. Something's going to be different about man. I'm going to have a spirit, my likeness will be inside this man, and he will be able to communicate with me. He will be able to fellowship with me. He will understand me, and I will understand him. We will connect. This is God's original purpose. The animals did not have this. Animals do not have a spirit and a soul. They have a body, a functioning body, for a purpose, for their limited time on this earth. But human beings were formed and created with a spirit that we can connect with God. That's why when we are saved, when we receive Christ as our Lord and Savior, our physical bodies don't get saved. That's just a shell that we're in. Our spirit becomes saved, reconnected back to the Lord. Our soul is saved, reconnected back to our Maker. And that's why the Scriptures tell us, do not walk in the flesh after the desires of the flesh, your body, with the five senses that we have, but walk after the Spirit. The Spirit's been renewed. The Spirit has been revived. It's been saved. It's been enlightened. And now follow the Spirit, and you won't indulge in the lust of the flesh and the pride of life and all these things that are carnal. The body itself will die because the body does not have a salvation to it. It is a physical being that we have been created, but inside of that body is that Spirit. And that Spirit will live forever. That soul will live forever. And God's purpose in making man is for us to be able to reconnect that Spirit with Him. And we have to pay attention to that, because that's one of the reasons we battle so much with the enemy. The enemy still uses this shell that we're in. He still uses our eyes and our ears and our taste, our touch. He uses these senses to try to drive us toward the carnal, fleshly lust and desires to feed this body, this desire that we have. But the spirit man inside of us wants to follow God. And once we feed that spirit man, then we will do the things that God would have us to do. And we won't try to feel or fulfill the lust of the flesh and the desires of the flesh. So the Spirit is critical when we're looking at the sanctity and the reverence and the importance of life, because that was the purpose of God, to put a Spirit inside of us and to give us, therefore, dominion over everything that He created. You know, it's interesting. I was listening to a minister one time where he basically said God gave us authority over all of His creation. Everything that God created, He gave man the authority to take care of it. And a man's authority, you know, when Satan entered the picture, Satan's purpose was to steal the authority, to have mankind submit to him and disobey God and try to steal the authority away from mankind that he could have it. He's always wanted authority, is what Satan has always wanted. But God gave clearly instructions to He and His Son and the Holy Spirit, as a Trinity in heaven talking amongst themselves on how they were going to create mankind, we are going to give Him dominion. So in verse 28, it said, "And God blessed them, and He said unto this man and woman, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." He wants us to fill the earth with His Spirit, with our offspring that's got a Spirit inside of them that God put in Adam and Eve from the beginning. "And subdue it," have authority over it, "have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." This was the key for God, that He wanted His spiritual beings, the ones that He has connected, created with His likeness, to have total authority and dominion to take care of it. And He gave Him a body to do that with. You know, as in my study, I found it interesting, and there's probably some animals out there that we might can come up with, but, you know, the body that He gave mankind was created for the purpose of having dominion over everything else. You know, if we're the only created being that walks upright on two legs. Now, somebody's going to say, I've seen gorillas do that, I've seen monkeys do that, and they can when they choose to, but they predominantly walk on all fours. And, you know, animals predominantly will walk on all fours in a inferior position where their heads face downward. Mankind is made to walk upward with his head up towards the heavens with dominion and authority over everything beneath him. And the body, the hands, the arms, the legs, giving him the ability to do whatever is needed and necessary to have that authority, whether it's to till the land, to provide for the, you know, to tend to the animals, whatever it is needed. Our bodies were created for that purpose, was to have dominion and to be able to use our bodies for dominion and authority over all of God's creation. So everything's going along good. God created us for this purpose. We understand that. We're thankful for that. But then we know in the Scriptures that Satan, who is there, caused jealousy to rise up in some of these created beings. And we know the story that Cain killed his brother Abel out of jealousy. For the first time, death entered into the picture, where someone took the life, the sanctity of life, from another individual. The first murder, the first death, physical death prematurely, was when Cain killed Abel. And as I studied this week, I realized that what was the punishment for Cain? Surely God would punish Cain, and he did. He sent him out of the garden, sent him away from his connections to his family. He says, you know, I'm going to banish you from the garden. You're going to be a wanderer. You're going to be wandering away, a vagabond, someone just wandering away. And Cain says, this is too difficult for me. This is too great of a punishment. Whoever finds me will kill me. We don't know what that means. We don't know when God put a mark on Cain so that anyone that would find him would not slay him. We don't know what that means. But we do know that at the time, God did not require the life of Cain to pay for the life of Abel. He himself, who created mankind, did not punish Cain with death. He punished him with abandonment from what he was familiar with. It's only after Noah's day do we find that God creates a policy or a command over what to happen to when innocent life is taken. We know that in the sixth chapter of Genesis that Noah's day is filled with a lot of violence. It's filled with a lot of corruption, so much so that God repented of ever creating mankind. None of the rest of his animals, I mean, we don't really get an idea of if he's repenting of all of his creation, but he's certainly repenting of what he's done with man or what he's created with man, because they've corrupted themselves so much that God's going to put an end to them. So he sends the flood because of the violence of man. He sends the flood and destroys everything that he created except for Noah and his sons. But it's in the ninth chapter that when Noah comes out of the ark, him and his sons, that God speaks to him, and he's going to make reference to what happens when innocent blood is shed. He says in chapter 9, verses 5 and 6, and says, "And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it. And at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man." And here's the key part in verse 6. "Whosoever sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man." The Bible was clear to say that in Noah's day, God made a statement to Noah that whoever kills innocent blood, sheds innocent blood, his blood will be required of him. Why? Why now? But God puts in here, because man was made in the image of God, and to kill a person, an innocent person, you're killing a being that was made in God's image. Here again, holding a sanctity of view, a view of sanctity about other human beings. I will not take the life of another human being because that human being was made in the image of God. Now, this, of course, strikes up the oftentimes contentious issue of capital punishment. God is giving a statement here in Noah's day in proportion of capital punishment. For those who shed innocent blood, their blood shall be shed as well. Now, of course, this drives people crazy who do not share in a pro-life viewpoint towards abortion. They don't understand why certain individuals will be pro-life for babies, but yet will promote capital punishment. Death is included in capital punishment. Well, what most people, from what I understand, that follow this pattern, it's all about innocence versus guilty. It's all about preserving the life of the innocent who's done nothing wrong versus punishing the person who has taken life innocently and on purpose, willfully destroyed the image of God in that and did not hold the sanctity of life dear. When I look back, I thought to myself, now we holding life, sanctifying life or having the sanctity of it in our mind's eye, where do we lose this viewpoint? Where do we stop looking at people in the perspective how God looks at them? What does it do? What do we get bombarded with daily where we become numb to this? Because as I said earlier, we're numb to death when we see it on the news. We see it so much. We can see atrocities and we can just shake our head at it, but it doesn't affect us as deeply as it possibly should, and it's because we're so inundated with it. As he was saying, in the day of Noah, violence was the reason God brought destruction upon the land in Noah's day. That was the reason he gave, is violence covered the earth, and violence is covering the earth today. We are in the days of Noah just by the pure essence of all the amount of violence out there. And it can be so subtle, as the enemy, you know, his purpose is to come and kill, steal, and to destroy. And he does it in so many subtle ways to numb us of it. I'm reminded of some of the, we have so much mass shootings these days. In the last 25 years, it seems like we can't get through a month without a mass shooting. And I'm always amazed, especially the younger ones who do this horrific act, how much ties they have to video games and things that they commonly use. And I have known, I've worked with younger men who are almost addicted to video games, where killing of individuals is the game. It is an addiction because it is you against the enemy, and you can do whatever you need to do to kill it. And these video games, if you've ever been able to see a portion of it, they do not spare the bloodshed. They do not spare the violence. And it is purpose, if the enemy has brought this on, the purpose of this is to numb the senses, to numb the identity of the sanctity of human life to the young minds who are indulging in this. Now, I'm not saying that every person who plays a video game is going to go out and partake of this. Obviously, it takes a mental disability to a point where people feel like they can go out and just kill people because it's nothing there. It'll bring them prestige and honor because of what they see. But these are the kind of things that Satan uses, whether it's video games, whether it's the news, whether nightly, whether it's movies and TV programs where, you know, I was thinking there's nothing that I enjoy more than a good old Western. And, you know, when I was a kid, I put on my cat pistols and we went out and we shot bad guys. That's what we did, you know, and I'm certainly wanting to defend Westerns. But it was a subtle start back then where, you know, the good guy shot the bad guy and there was no blood and guts everywhere. It was just he folded over and he passed away and the good guy won. He was the hero. He got the girl in the end and everything was great. But when you look at Westerns, as innocent as they were back in those days, they were somewhat of a preamble to what we see today. They didn't take life. Life was just something that, you know, you got rid of the bad people and the good people would prevail. And now it digressed into killing innocent people on these video games and in these shows where now it's mystery, murder mysteries and things like that. And I'm not trying to put a depression on you not to be able to watch anything, but it kind of gives you an idea on how we are desensitized to human life and how when we hear these atrocities, it no longer moves us like it should. We don't see it as innocent images of God that have had their lives taken away from them immediately for whatever purpose of vengeance or just curiosity that these people have. So we're up against this thing that we have to be reminded of this. And it all starts, as in Psalms 139, as we go into the middle section of our lesson today, where David himself, a thinker, I would imagine. David was anybody that's a poet and a ponderer of things who writes Psalms, he most likely did a lot of thinking, introspective thinking in his day, because you can tell in the Psalms that he wrote that it was in his mind. And, of course, we know how great of a person David wound up being. But at the same time, he knew early on, before sonograms and ultrasounds and all of that, 3,000 years before medicine would be able to see an infant in the belly of a mother, he knew that God created mankind from conception inside the mother's womb, and that was the process that God used and created to bring forth life, human life in particular, because God certainly wanted to perpetuate what he had created. So in the starting with verse 13 of the chapter of 139 or the 139th Psalm, he's talking to the Lord. And he says, "For thou hast possessed my reins, or you've formed my inward parts. You've created my inward parts. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. In my mother's womb was where you were there. You were there creating me. And this is important for us. This is why we take a stand the way we do and being pro-life over the innocence of inside of a mother's womb. God was there, as David is saying. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works that my soul knoweth right well. My substance, or who I am, everything from my body parts, the blood, the sinews, the bone, the vessels, everything was not hid from you. You had a part in every bit of me, the creation of me. When I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. When he talks about lowest parts of the earth, I didn't know what in the world he was talking about. Most of the commentaries I tried to read on this is just, it's a reference meaning mysterious place. When no one at that time knew how a baby formed in a mother's stomach. No one knew how that a baby could be conceived was the easy part. But how that seed and egg would form into a human being that they knew was a complicated being. They would, whenever they didn't know anything, it was a mystery. They would use a terminology in the lowest parts of the earth where no one truly knows what's going on. That's what he's referring to. God, you were there. We don't know how it did, but we marvel at your works and your abilities to create it. Your eyes did see my substance. You saw all about me. Yet being imperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them. Talking about you knew who I would become. You knew what kind of personality I would have. You would know a purpose for my life. You would have a direction for my life. Even as I was being formed in my mother's womb, you had a plan for my individual life. He doesn't do this for animals. He doesn't do this for plants. He doesn't have a purpose or an individual a life's plan for animals. They are a function of the world, but they are not a fellowship with God. But mankind, the sanctity of human life, is that God is forming you in the womb, and he knows your person as it's going to be. David is saying, you're going to know that I'm going to start out being a shepherd and a soldier and a poet and a psalmist and a king. You've already planned this. You already have seen what my abilities that you have given me will happen. And therefore, I am wonderfully made because you, Almighty God, can see all of this before I ever come out of my mother's womb. The sanctity of life. When we talk about protecting the unborn child and the sanctity of human life, it is truly about the innocence of that life and the sanctity of that life. I certainly can stand here and say that I understand some of the opposition's reasonings, all right, from a secular standpoint. I understand when a young person may say, my life is just starting, I can't hinder my life's plan with having a child. Or I can understand when someone says, I can't afford a child, or I've got a plan for my life, or the father of my child does not want to go forward, so I'm going to have to raise this child on my own. There are multitudes of reasonable answers and reasons why ending this life would be, in a secular sense, understandable. But from us viewing the life as an image of God made into that womb, no matter how it comes about, or the timing, or the inconvenience, no matter what those factors that may be reasonable to the world, we have to look at the life inside. That innocent life has no one crying out for them. That innocent life has no one defending them. And we take a stand on the sanctity of life because no matter what the cause and circumstance, that life is there, and it was part of the process, created in the process that God set aside. It may not have happened the way God intended it to happen. It may not have happened in the situation that God intended it to happen, but the life is still there and it's still sanctified as far as a living and breathing human being. So we take a stand for that. We take a stand for the life of the innocent. When we get into the book of Acts, the whole Old Testament has been talking about life itself. And the Old Testament's an interesting book when you're talking about the purpose of life and the sanctity of life, because the Old Testament is truly a struggle. It's a struggle for a nation of people to survive. And to survive in a violent world, a world of barbarianism and all this, for the state of Israel, the nation of Israel that God would form, it was a constant struggle that required warfare and the loss of life, sometimes and many times sanctioned by God himself in warfare, never taking the innocent life, but through warfare is predominantly looked at as a way of preserving a nation. And that's why the Old Testament, even though it promotes life, it also sees a lot of death in it. But we as Christian believers, we acknowledge the fact that warfare still resides in a fallen world. It is still permitted way of death is through warfare. We don't have to enjoy it. We don't have to engage in it. We don't have to condone it, but we acknowledge it. But when it becomes to the innocent life and how we view people or the image of God, we have to understand that we have to change our perspective about individuals. Even those that do us harm, even those that have different political persuasions and all that, they are still a person made in the image of God that we have to take a viewpoint on. Paul is trying to do that because when he goes into this 17th chapter of Acts, this is the time when he has visited Athens, and Athens, Greece, where philosophers have been around for hundreds of years, and they've tried to determine what's the meaning of life, and where do all these people come from? Possibly, I would imagine, if you were in Athens and you would gather in these meeting halls where philosophers would sit around and talk about why are we here on this earth and what's the meaning of life and why do some look this way, why are some this color, and why do these cultures differ from other cultures, is possibly very fascinating to listen to different theories. Paul comes on the scene, and he knows that they're talking about all these different things, and these questions are still asked today. You know, why do we all look different? Why do we, why do we come from different parts of the earth? But Paul tries to simplify it here. He tries to bring everything back into the center of the sanctity of life. When he goes up and he sees that image that they've built to the memorial to the unknown God. The answers we don't know are they belong to a God that we don't even know, so we're going to put up a monument to this unknown God who has all the answers that we're trying to solve. Paul sees this, and he goes in amongst them, and he starts talking to them, giving them the most simplistic answer, this God that you don't know about, I'm going to tell you who he is and how he connects everybody to him. It says, and he's explaining God. He says, God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, he is the God that created everything you see. One God did this. A multitude of gods did not create all these things. You don't have a God of the sky and the God of the ocean and the God of the land who only had a purpose in developing their particular item. God created all these things. And because he's the Lord of heaven and earth, he doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. You can't put him in a box. He's too great. Neither is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things. This is a powerful God that Paul is exclaiming to these philosophers. And here's the part he ties everybody in. He says in verse 26, and he hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. He is telling these philosophers that more than animals, God has taken a particular attention to human life. All these humans that may be flowing in of Athens of different colors and cultures and mannerisms, and you're trying to fit, where do they come from? How do we all, are we all related? Are we all different? Paul's putting it pretty simple and says they are all human beings, maybe from different parts of the world, but one God created all of them. The same blood resides in all of them, blood given to them by God in his created methodology, and he's brought them all together, and he is the God of all of them. And not only has he created all these individuals, but he has taken a particular liking in their individual lives. He's determined the bounds of their habitation and the times before appointed, meaning that he knows when they're going to be born. He knows when they're going to die. He knows the plan of life they have for each and every purpose, for each and every person that walks the face of the earth. We can't understand that. We can't comprehend it. 8 billion people, and God knows every one of them by name. God not only knows each one of them by name, but he has a purpose for them. And so many of them, out of the 8 billion people, I would imagine over half of them don't even acknowledge him. But yet he still knows each and every one of them and cares for them and has a plan of action, a plan of purpose for them. We can only, it'll boggle our mind to try to bring that into captivity in our minds, but we try to take the simple way and say, let me just bring that home to me. God knows me. He knew when I was going to be born, in what century and what decade I was going to be born in. He has a purpose for my life that if I walk with him, it's going to be a good purpose. It's going to be a fulfilling purpose. If I stay with him, I may not be wealthy. I may not live longer than my grandparents lived or something. But I will be fulfilled if I walk in my purpose with the Lord, because I trust that he's got one for me. And that's my purpose. I'm not going to worry about everything else. I know the only thing I'm going to do when I look at 8 billion people is I'm going to realize there are 8 billion people that were made in the image of God. No matter what color, nationality, culture, no matter how many of them protest in the streets and I get enraged when I hear what they say and how they do their demagoguery and I just get enraged by it, I have to remind myself that they are made in the image of God. It's a human life. And it changes my perspective on them totally so that I don't wish ill about them. I don't wish their death. Instead, I try to promote life, because God, in his knowledge and his love and care, made human beings for a purpose to rule over his creation and to fellowship individually with him while they are here on this earth in the time that he has preappointed for us to live here. This is our time in life. And all the history of mankind and all the future ahead of us, until God comes and takes us all away, this is our time in life to make the most of our lives in his purpose and to hold the sanctity of life close and dear to us. We'll close it down with that today. Next week, as we've gotten a better idea of human life itself and how to have a better perspective on it, next week we're going to get into more controversial stuff. The next few weeks, we're going to be talking about things that are prevalent and growing rapidly throughout our land, things that are fought over and seems to be no end to these things. But we are going to study these things and ponder them, and I hope you'll enjoy it as we study and go through it. So we will see you next week.